standby for the Debbie Smith Band. We'll be going until 2 o'clock tonight, live on the WYSO Nightclub of the Year.
Hey, Juliet, I've got yet another gem from the WYSO archives for you.
Oh, yeah? What you got?
It's a tape from 1980 of a band fronted by a woman named Debbie Smith. Recorded at the Walnut Hills. It used to be a bar on Wayne Avenue in Dayton. Full disclosure, she's an old friend of mine.
Well, I wake up in the night.
Oh, wow. Listen to her sing.
Yeah, we've got a couple recordings of her in the archives. This one from when WYSO producers routinely went out and broadcast live shows on air or recorded them for later.
Tell me more.
Well, we've already established that Dayton had a hot live music scene, especially in the bars and clubs, like the Walnut Hills, the Trolley Stop, the Oregon Express, the Night Owl, and of course Canal Street Tavern, and Jilly's. And there were some famous national acts that came through town, like the queen of the blues herself, Coco Taylor, and her band, The Blues Machine. Here they are, live at Jilly's, Jerry Gelati's downtown club, recorded by WYSO's Larry Blood, Dave Barber, and Chuck Ganzert in 1979.
Electric lights go out. A candlelight will see you through. When you
But as we've also established, few local bands were fronted by women, or even featured women players back in the 80s, and prior too. And I think it's safe to say that the Dayton band scene of the time was male-dominated, especially in terms of the rock genre.
Yeah, that's right. And that's what this episode is all about. How women created space and community in the midst of a lively but mostly male-dominated local music scene, in part through the Dayton Women's Music Collective. And as you'll hear, we're able to tell that story because WYSO engineers and music hosts were involved in that scene, recording live performers at venues or hosting them in studio. And those recordings are preserved in our archives. So to begin, let's talk about the Debbie Smith Band. It was really something different because Deb is really something different. I sat down with her a while back to talk about her experiences, about what it was like to be a woman fronting a rock band.
I would lay in bed at night with my little transistor radio pressed against my ear, listening and counting how many songs would go by before I would finally hear a lead female vocalist. And then wondering how was I gonna fit into that world. And then just by sheer determination, didn't know what else to do because I loved music so much, plugging away at it and just kind of without really having a master plan, just going out and playing anywhere and everywhere I could. By the time I had just been playing, what, a year or two in bars before I was approached to join this band, disco was on the way out. It was the tail end of it. When 79, like the top six songs are all disco. Country rock was just starting to really kind of come into things. I was very much into the LA rock sound of Bonnie Raitt, Little Feet, and that's what the band quickly grabbed onto. We were all interested in that sound, kind of a country rock, blues. The guys in the band were just extremely talented and able to play any style, which was really fun for me to this day. I love listening to a lot of different styles of music and trying my hand at all of them. So we had a lot of fun, but I also think that it made it a little difficult to categorize us. But I know that as a female fronting this band of full of guys in, what, 79, 80, 81, it was kind of tricky. I think at the time, I didn't know what labels to give it. To what I was experiencing. I knew that I needed to be careful for my personal safety. I knew that as a queer person, I needed to protect myself from any kind of a backlash. I mean, this is, again, around 1980 in Dayton, where there wasn't much of a sense of acceptance or respect or understanding. And here I was trying to break into the local music scene, and I was out in high school, Catholic high school, but I wasn't really making any effort to really broadcast it. I had my own sense of shame or discomfort around it that I was dealing with. So here I am trying to compete with other females playing in other women in the area in bands, wearing spandex and looking, you know, hot. And then there's me, you know, with my T-shirt and my jeans and just trying to appeal to everyone and make great music. But yes, always feeling that pressure to be sexy, to be, you know, mysterious or risque. And for the most part, it seemed people didn't care. The people that genuinely liked the band didn't care. But yeah, there were comments made. There were times where a couple of guys in the band had to defend my honor and keep certain people away from me. There were times I was followed home, propositioned. It was pretty crazy. It was uncomfortable for me at times, yeah.
So you did experience some fame with the band, though, locally. Tell me about that, some performances and certainly a recording opportunity.
I think one thing that helped was that I had a distinctive hairstyle. I had the big permed hair, and that kind of stood out at the time. So I think I was kind of easily recognized and would be approached when I was doing my laundry and, hey, aren't you that girl? And that was kind of fun, you know, to get that kind of notice.
Juliet, I've admired Deb's musicianship since I first met her, probably a little while after that Walnut Hills recording was made. We've been friends that long. See, I was part of that scene myself back then.
Really?
Yep. In 81, I was a 20-something part-time college student who landed a job slinging beer at the trolley stop, one of the bars in Dayton's entertainment district. For years, East 5th Street had mostly been the site of empty storefronts, XXX movie theaters, and adult bookstores, which still compete with the retail shops and trendy restaurants and bars on that little stretch of East 5th we call the Oregon District. Anyway, I met a man who played music there and ended up moving in with him, and that's mostly another story. Important to this one only in that it located me in the heart of the music scene, a proximity that placed me at the nexus of live music at the local bars and the listening room that was Canal Street Tavern. Man, there was so much good music back then. I was focused on folk and a bit of Celtic, singing ballads and playing the flute and penny whistle, as I'd mentioned earlier. I heard a lot of music that resonated with me on WYSO, on shows like Phyllis Brzozowska's Celtic Folkweave, the folk show Potpourri, hosted by Ed Humphrey, Norm Whitman's Detours, and of course, on Women in Music, too. I learned songs I'd heard on the radio, and many of those artists played live at Canal Street's Women's Music Series. National artists like Sally Fingerette, Cheryl Wheeler, Dar Williams. But this was well before the time of Rhiannon Giddens or Alison Russell and other women of color who now embrace roots music from wherever their roots grow, so I was sort of an oddity. I sang a little backup in a band with a boyfriend, but that was complicated, especially when the relationship became on again, off again, and I needed my own musical identity. So I found a kindred spirit with whom to play, a fellow by the name of Carl Trepea. We used to play sets of mostly folk tunes from the UK. You know, my dad was black, but my mom's from Great Britain, so the music resonated with me. Here we are from my own archives, back in the mid-80s.
Oh, let's hear this.
I once loved a lass, and I loved her so well. And I hated all others who spoke of her ill. And now she's rewarded me well for my love. Oh, she's gone and she's wed another.
That's great.
Yeah, I was a very serious balladeer back in the day.
So, Jocelyn, I'm going to put on my music interviewer hat for a minute here. What was it like for you stepping into your identity as a folk singer?
Well, you know, folk music had been around me from the time I was a little kid. And, you know, I listened to Peter, Paul, and Mary growing up. And, you know, and Simon and Garfunkel and the sort of folk influences in that music. There was a lot of it, you know, a lot of folk music influences in contemporary music all around in the 60s and 70s when I was growing up. So by this time, we're talking about, you know, the early 80s. I think that, you know, it helped me stay in touch with a part of my heritage and part of my you know, legacy from across the pond.
What was it like seeing other women on the stage as you were just starting out? Did that help empower you to find your voice?
Well, you know, I think that the music that I heard on WISO was really what empowered me, because I heard Steel Eisband and I heard, you know, a lot of, well, Sandy Denny, who I think I modeled myself after to some degree in Fairport Convention. You know, so that early music, that British folk rock invasion was really influential for me. I really saw inspiration in those women who were part of that scene.
So once you and Carl started playing together, how did the two of you kind of enter the music scene?
So yeah, you know, we played open mics around town, and that's where I first met Debbie Smith. She had shifted away from the band doing solo sets, and we have tape of that shift in the WYSO archives. She'd come up to the radio station on the second floor of the Antioch Student Union to play her guitar and sing, and the session was engineered once again by Larry Blood, former WYSO program director and an Antioch grad, who's now a radio producer out in Cali.
Gosh, she was just amazing. She was doing a sort of a bluesy style of singing mostly, but she also did folk songs, and she just had an incredible voice. That she's one of the people whom, when you hear people say that the room gets as quiet where you could hear a pin drop, every time she would perform, it was like that. It was very magical to hear her play.
That's my old musical partner, Carl Trepea. Hearing Deb Smith play was an inspiration to those of us who aspired to play out. There'd been open mics for the Folky Set in Dayton for years at the Lemon Tree Coffee House on Wayne Avenue, then Sam's Bar and Grill, and later at Canal Street Tavern, of course. Lots of local musicians came up playing them, and college campuses, especially Antioch's C Shop and UD with its Monk's Inn Coffee House, were pretty hospitable.
But live music mostly happens in the bar and club scene in Dayton. Before the Oregon District, those venues were distributed throughout the city. They mostly featured rock, country, sometimes punk, and mostly male musicians. Folk, Celtic, women's music, lesbian, and mostly acoustic stages featuring singer-songwriters or music with a message were definitely fewer. And for some women, as we well know, the bar scene wasn't an environment that felt safe or comfortable as either a performer or audience member. And certainly there were some places then that felt safer than others. Finding a space where safety combined with respect for the performer and the subject of the performance wasn't always easy.
Well, you know, it's interesting because as a guy, listening to music, I never differentiated myself between women playing or men playing. I just thought everyone's a musician.
Carl remembers what the local music scene was like back then.
I did see that there was a barrier there for women to find places to perform that guys don't have. There's a bias, and it may not even be a conscious bias, but the bias is there all the same.
And that's part of why the Dayton Women's Music Collective came into being in 1982. It was a series of live shows organized by women and celebrating women musicians.
And once the women's collective started, that became even more apparent, because it made me realize, like, wow, where were all these women before? How come they never played at open mic night and things like that? But one of the things in my own memory that I do recall from Sam's, and this in my mind explains why they didn't play open stage night more often, is because one time at Sands, there was a young woman, she was playing the dulcimer. And she was incredible. She was playing pieces by Bach on the dulcimer. And you don't hear that on the dulcimer. Usually you hear just pretty lame, straight melodic things with a drone going. But she was playing Bach pieces, and two guys in the audience yelled out, "Nice tits." And I thought, that's horrible. The poor woman, she never came back again. And so the Dayton Women's Collective create a safe place for women like that to be able to play and not have to put up with those kind of shenanigans.
I found your letter in my mailbox today. You were just checking if I was okay.
I'm Jane Hawkinsmith Reich, and I am a musician and a potter. And I did perform at the Dayton Women's Music Collective and the Leo Coffee House in Cincinnati, and Monk's Inn, which I almost forgot about, and just people's homes. Yeah.
No need to tell me you'd like to be friends and help me get back on my feet again.
That's Jane making music back in the mid-80s. She tells the story of playing out at a local bar. It wasn't just the audience with questionable behavior.
And I remember this very clearly. I was halfway through my last set, and the guy turned the jukebox on. The owner of the bar turned the jukebox on. And it was so rude, and it was so insulting. But some of the people who were listening to me went to him and said, "Listen, we're listening to the music, you know." And so he did turn it back off. But it's just, you don't have to deal with that kind of stuff when you come to a place where people are there to listen to the music. I remember the Women's Collective, just, it was very refreshing to go. And I played in bars before, and I never liked the feeling of playing in bars. But having an audience of people that really came to listen to the music, at least that's what it felt like. It was a different kind of support, and it felt really very supportive. I really did enjoy it a lot during that time. It was just a really good time for music.
So a community of women came together to support each other in sharing the music we wanted to make, the Dayton Women's Music Collective. That's where I got to know Jane. We actually shared billing at the collective once, and Deb Smith and Connie Buchenroth, the late Chris Simon, Sharon Lane, and so many others. Like Sue Elam, the force behind the collective and a force in Dayton's LGBTQ community to this day. Sue's not a musician. She's more an impresario. I sat down with her at the trolley stop to look through old photos and news clippings about the collective.
So what do we got here? This is Sharon Lane with her back towards the audience, so she wore a mask on the back of her head so it looked like she was facing the audience. This is Chris Simon, and she would play every time she was ever asked, no matter what. She loved to play the collective, and she loved Farron. She played a lot of Farron songs, so she and I would have discussions where she would sway me to liking Farron songs. But she also wrote her own music. Chris wrote her own music, and we all miss Chris. Everybody loved Chris.
Yeah, she's a good soul.
She was. She's a very nice woman. Very supportive, very kind, loving soul. Yeah, here's Connie and Kate again. Here's Deb. There's not a lot of pictures of Deb playing anymore. Yeah. People didn't take pictures back then like they do now. We didn't have cell phones. And then this is an article that was done for us. But, you know, it's collectively these women make music. Great little heading. But it always felt like, no matter what question they asked, that it was leading, right? And they were trying to ask something without asking something. And I think they, you know, if they didn't, it kind of felt like they had their own agenda as to the whole reason they were doing the article or trying to get another story. It just got a little uncomfortable for everybody. And, you know, not everybody was out, right? And so they didn't necessarily want their name in print attached to something that may or may not be a lesbian event. So, you know, you get protective of people and you don't want to out them and you don't, right? It's not, it was a totally different world in 1980. What year was this?
Ah, here we go. 1985.
Yeah. There was a different world back in 1985. It's not like it is now. I mean, everybody wasn't accepting and there weren't laws to protect women or people in general of their sexuality, and you know, people get fired from their jobs for simply appearing at one of these things or being seen at one of these things. And, you know, while it wasn't a lesbian-centric group of people, it, you know, it gave lesbians some place to go and a safe place to be. And so it sometimes became a lesbian-centric event. So I haven't even read this article in a long time, so...
I'm incredibly embarrassed by my quote in it.
Are you? What'd you say? See ya.
I said something really goofy about, like, oh, we're not anti-men, we're just up with people.
Hands across America. Yeah. Yeah, I mean... Everybody was welcome to come. You just, you know, don't be an idiot, right? Behave yourself. But everybody was welcome to come, and they would pack out on Monday night. Sometimes we would conflict with softball schedules. It's true, you know. Sounds stereotypical, but sometimes, you know, we'd conflict with softball schedules, and so we'd have to figure that out. Or, you know, where is everybody? Oh, they'll be here after the game, you know. But. It was an amazing time.
The Dayton Women's Music Collective was organized for all women, not just lesbians. But part of the origin story involves a conversation with club owner Mick Montgomery.
Dottie and I were sitting at Canal Street before it had a sign one night and said, then it was still Evelyn's Cafe outside. And, he, you know, Mick and his wow man conversations, right? Hey, man. So where do you guys go to listen to music? Meaning lesbians, right? And we said, we don't. He says, why don't you come here? So we're like, okay. So that's how it started. But Mick gave us a safe place to be when there was no safe place to be. And there certainly wasn't a place we could go to listen to live music from other women, no matter who they were, right? So Mick did something pretty amazing. He started something that, you know, other people weren't doing, and a lot of people didn't have the courage to do. So, you know, everybody knows what we all owe Mick Montgomery for as far as Canal Street Tavern, but the lesbian community in particular owes him something extra. Because he protected us, and he took care of us, and he wouldn't let anybody mess with us if they did come in. And, you know, he gave us a safe space before we knew what the word safe space meant. And, yeah, we're very lucky to have had him here. Not a lot of places were doing this outside of California.
Hey, Julia, can we just talk about Canal Street for a minute? Because it's kind of its own amazing story.
It really is. You know, Mick always billed Canal Street as a listening room, which was unique in and of itself. Yeah, it had a bar, but it was designed as a space to listen to music.
It really was. And the music that I heard there, not just through the collective and the musicians co-op on Tuesday nights, but what an incredible number of artists he was able to bring into that space. It's really a who's who of acoustic musicians, singer-songwriters. It's just amazing.
And we're talking about a lasting legacy here because you're talking about your experiences at Canal Street in the 80s. I came up going to Canal Street in the late 90s and early 2000s, and through that entire period, Mick was bringing in those national artists, often, you know, folks just emerging out on their first tour, while simultaneously giving musicians of all stripes and all levels of ability an opportunity to perform on what was considered a serious stage in our community.
It certainly was a serious stage, and it was a real privilege and a joy to play there for sure.
In addition to the national acts that came in, that tradition of open mic stages really served as a proving ground for so many local musicians. It's a tradition that continues today, but back in the day, the Musicians Co-op, first hosted by Mick Montgomery at Sam's Bar and Grill and later at Canal Street, gave many familiar names their start. There's even a film about Musicians Co-op that you can find online, but the names that come to mind for me are Jane Sachs, WISO's own Todd Widener, and, you know, that connection with WISO was really strong. Mick was also a music host on WISO at one time.
No doubt Mick was masterful at programming his little listening room in Dayton, Ohio, with nationally and internationally known musicians. He used to keep the schedule in one of those little pocket calendars you used to get from the bank, and the names were a who's who in the acoustic music world. Taj Mahal, Rory Block, John Hartford, Odetta, Christine Lavin, Garnet Rogers, and so many more. There's an online database called the Canal Street Gigology that lists the performers from his pocket calendar, and it's beyond impressive. But every Tuesday night, it was all local voices, and in 1983, Sharon Lane took over as the host of the Musicians Co-op, and that began decades of earthy storytelling and bluesy piano stylings by a woman who didn't start out to be a Dayton music icon. Here's tape of Juliet's show Kaleidoscope from a couple of years ago.
A performer I have admired for many years, and I'm so honored to have her here on the show. She's got a whole slew of friends in the house. I want to welcome the lovely Miss Sharon Lane, who's going to start off gracing us with a song.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here. This is like coming home, you know. When you wake up in the morning, hear the word bell ring, and they march you to the table, you hear the same old thing. Well, ain't no food on that table, ain't no pork in the pan. Oh, you better not complain, boy, you get in trouble with them, and oh, let them.
We've got miles of tape of Sharon in the WISO archives, performing solo and with musical friends over the years. She was a regular performer at the Dayton Women's Music Collective, always on the first Monday of the month at Canal Street, and she emceed the Musicians Co-op every Tuesday night for years. But her life as a performer came after finding herself a divorced single mom.
You know, the situation back when I was growing up was that music was a hobby. It wasn't anything that you pursued. And yet even what you would pursue was different than, you know, I was to get married and have kids and, you know, make brownies or whatever that was supposed to be, you know. So even playing music when I was young, family-wise and things like that, even community-wise, wasn't accepted well. You know, it's like, put that away. Do that after the kids go to bed, you know. Oh, you can play in your living room. And that's what I did. I got married because I thought, well, that's what you do. But then I started doing a little band work, you know. And then my husband and I had a band then, and that was it. I started playing out, and that was a different way of being received, I think, probably is the best way to put it. And then I'd say, oh, my goodness, you can't be doing that. You know, go back in the closet. That's not what you're supposed to be doing. You're supposed to be a mom and wash dishes and work at the local restaurant or something, you know. And so, there was different times where I stepped back, and I didn't do a whole lot. I was still writing, though. I stayed with that because that could be kept in a book hidden in the closet. I wasn't reared that we went to college. That's so I didn't even think about going to college. I just was glad to get out of high school and take off and do what I want to do, and found out that I may want to do it, but the world didn't want me to.
Tell me about that. Wait, do you remember having an awakening? Do you remember what that was like?
I don't know if I can pinpoint one thing, But getting a credit card, you can get credit cards, and you had to have a man sign for your credit card. Yet when I was married, when we got divorced, he got the credit. I had none. The minute I walked out of the courthouse, even though I was the one paying them, even though my name was on it, I had no credit. And that was an eye awakening.
So you're a young mother. You're making a little music. You get divorced. And do you start making more music?
Yeah. There was a lot of stigma for women doing that. You had to be doing drugs, or, you know, you had to be out of your mind. You had to be loose. You had to be all those things that at that time, if you were called that, was very hurtful. It's still hurtful. I mean, it's a hurtful thing to be called things that you're not anyhow, you know. And I had this little girl that I was going to be rearing by myself pretty much, you know, a part-time, every other weekend father sometimes. And the one thing that I don't regret is she needed a home. I had the house, and she had a swing set. I just didn't even think about this at first, because I just sat down at the piano and just started writing music and writing songs and singing for me and my daughter, whether she liked it or not. She was my audience, you know. And I had started working at Canal Street Tavern. My goal was to get a set put together that I could go do somewhere, you know, and be proud of it and not make mistakes and not shake all over the place.
So Sharon got that set together, and she started playing out at the co-op and the collective and beyond. Managing the bar for Mick gave her the opportunity to learn from and sometimes share the stage with professional musicians from all over and from her own backyard. Over the years, she honed her craft to become the area's most beloved and respected musical godmother.
You know, Jocelyn, there's kind of a running joke in our musical community that Sharon Lane is welcome on any stage at any place. She simply needs to walk into the room and step up, and she's invited in. But being able to hold that place in our music community, that takes time and nurturing, and co-op and the Dayton Women's Music Collective provided that space for someone like Sharon to really get comfortable in that stage environment.
Yeah, you know, how do you get experience other than, you know, showing up and just doing your thing? But being able to do it when you're so vulnerable and when you're starting out or you're trying new material, I think that the, you know, our open stages have been just an amazing tradition here. And, you know, it's great that Sharon is not only came up in that tradition, but is continuing that tradition. Sharon is one of the few musicians from that 1980s era who has continued to be part of the scene. Here she is with her musical partner, Danny Sowers, at their regular Thursday night gig at Trailtown Brewery in Yellow Springs, where they host different guest performers every week. They're introducing Kyleen Downs, who we'll learn more about in our next episode.
We have a really special night tonight because Kyleen Downs, who I absolutely adore, is sharing her talent with us. Kyleen, she does all kinds of some of the coolest stuff ever with children and teaching, and she is a badass woman in music.
So she runs the open mic every Tuesday night over here at Peaches.
Yeah. Every Tuesday night you can go in and do the open mic over here at Peaches, and Kyleen will take care of you if you want to play. And it's pretty cool that she does that. That's an important part of being a musician, is having places that you can go play like that.
Talking with Sharon, I had the chance to ask her to share some of her hard-earned wisdom. You know, as a somebody who mentors and who supports, what advice do you have for women musicians today?
Stay true to who you are. Don't worry about if you don't sound like someone else or you don't play like someone else. And if you've got that burning desire, stay true to it. Don't let anybody do. I used to tell my kids this too. Don't let an adult take that away from you. Don't listen to them. I don't care if it's your mom, if your dad, your brother, your sister, your next door neighbor. You hold on to that flame. And when you need help, you reach out and take it. Go to someone you trust. So if you need help and you want someone to help you in your music or your painting or whatever it is that you choose to do, know who to reach out to. And don't let anybody take that away from you. And work hard at it. You're allowed to. Your dishes will always be there. Your dishes will be in the sink when you get done writing that song. Your clothes will go into the hamper eventually. You know, prioritize. You are allowed to prioritize your talent no matter what that is, no matter what you choose. So if it's the arts that you choose, you are allowed to prioritize that. Even if you're a wife, even if you're a mother, even if your dishes are dirty, even if you have a flat tire on your car, finish the song first, paint the picture first. You're allowed to do that. Do not let anyone convince you that it's a hobby. You'll know if it's a hobby. You'll know if it's something you want to do in your spare room, and you don't care if you ever show the picture or you ever sing in front of it. You'll know that, and that'll be your choice. But don't let someone take it from you, ever, ever. Hold on with both hands and learn how to cuss a lot.
The Dayton Women's Music Collective shut down in 1998. Canal Street Tavern closed in 2013, and that iteration of Musicians Co-op ended. As you heard, some keep going, like Sharon, and others, like Debbie Smith, have set it aside despite their talent and love for music.
I'm still playing music myself, in a woodwind quintet. My days as a folk singer are over, but we still need spaces for women to make music and to grow as creators, like the open mic at Peaches that Kyleen Downs hosts, and spaces where women feel supported and safe. Here's Sue Elam.
I don't know, there's something special about all this. You know, the sad thing is that we needed this space, right? You know, it's hard for women to find places to play. I was just having this discussion the other day with some people, some straight white guys who are in a band, you know, have hats and beards. And I said, I had complained for a number of years about music, local music, is all straight white guys playing the same basic music, you know, in a different genre maybe. But they all have, you know, can you book somebody besides guys with hats and beards playing the same songs? And they said, that's what everybody comes to see. And I said, have you put anybody else in front of them? And they always, well, you know. But I mean, if you feed somebody soup every day, they get used to eating soup, right? And it's hard for women still to this day to get booked in and have the same opportunities that men do at presenting their music. I mean, it's the occasional thing. I mean, there's Amber Hargitz and the Rachel Literals and the Sam Kings and all that, but how often, comparatively, how often do you see them to men playing out? Not as much. And yeah, it is harder for them. Then, back in the collective days, it was even harder, you know. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been offered space. We didn't have any place. There was nothing. So the very idea that we needed a night set aside to highlight women's music, however they wanted to present that, says a lot about how women struggle just to get into music and how it's different for them as opposed to, you know, instead of men. So I don't know. I don't think anything's changed that much. I've often considered bringing back the collective, but I don't know.
One woman's voice in the WYSO archives is especially important to defining musical spaces. Nikki Dakota was music director and host of the Daily Show Excursions for nearly two decades. A performer herself, her deep knowledge of music and musicians, her warmth and vulnerability on air defined WYSO's sound and laid the foundation for music hosts from jazz to bluegrass and everything in between. Here she is from the WYSO archives
interviewing Nashville-based singer-songwriter Mary Gaucher on Excursions in the spring of 2018.
It is just about 7 minutes past 2 o'clock on a gorgeous day in the Miami Valley, made just a little bit more so gorgeous by our guest this hour. It's been 13 years between visits, and I'm just proud and delighted to welcome back to Excursions, Mary Gaucher. Hi, Mary.
How can you possibly remember that?
I remember it really clearly.
Do like,
you? Let me tell you part of the reason why, because you've led one of the most movie-worthy lives, I think, that's ever been lived from your time. It's amazing to me. Orphan, born and raised in Louisiana, but you took out early, you adopted, ran away. You had even spent a time as a culinary expert. There was so much to it. And we were talking about it. I was like, your life seems so delightful. And I remember you thinking, not the word I would have put on there. I just remember when I was yesterday, I was like, wow, Nikki, work harder for your adjectives and support. But it was such a really wonderful, wonderful interview. Mercy Now had just come back, or I should say, had just been released, and you were making a swing and came by our old studios in the basement of Sontag Fells.
I bet I was playing for Mick in Dayton.
I'll bet you were.
Good old Mick.
You know, he recently passed.
He wasn't hardly any good. 13 years ago, he was hanging on.
I know.
A sweet, sweet man. And what a great community spirit he built in that little club of his. I loved him. I loved him at the end of the night.
But Nikki's lasting legacy isn't just her time on WYSO's airwaves. It's also her daughter, Eleanor Dakota, a gifted singer who's been performing since she was a wee one. Eleanor's been the featured vocalist in several local music projects, including Crabs Without Legs, one of the hottest young bands in the region. Also from WYSO's archives, here's Eleanor Dakota, sitting in with Bird Brain Breakfast on Juliet's live local music show Kaleidoscope in the spring of 2023.
Voices like Eleanor's are the present and the future. And that's where we're heading in our final episode. We may not have the Dayton Women's Music Collective now, but spaces for women musicians are still needed. And Eleanor is just one of the women who is creating those spaces today.
That's next time on Rediscovered Radio, Women's Voices, Women's Music in the WYSO Archives. This episode was produced by me, Jocelyn Robinson, with WYSO Music Director Juliet Frumholt. Sound design is by Tom Amrine. Jesse Dukes is the editor. Check out our webpage to see old snapshots of the Dayton Women's Music Collective, the short film about the Musicians Co-op, and for a link to Mick Montgomery's Gigology. And don't forget, up with people! Just peace and love.